This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iran nuclear deal assured of U.S. Senate approval. Yemen faces humanitarian disaster. Whale deaths triple in Alaska.
We might be able to, you know, figure out, is it a virus? Is it, a ship strike? Is it a harmful algal bloom?
And Justin Bieber is making some new music. We'll hear what that's all about. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Champagne corks might be popping at the White House. After a long-fought battle for congressional support, it appears the Iran nuclear deal may have the backing it needs to sustain an expected presidential veto. Maryland Democratic Senator Barbara Mikulski is the 34th member of the Senate to commit to supporting the pact. Senator Mikulski said no deal is perfect, but this is the best option to block Tehran from getting the bomb. Iran insists its nuclear endeavors are for peaceful purposes only. Secretary of State John Kerry took his argument for the nuclear agreement on Wednesday to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
2 months ago, in Vienna, the United States and five other nations, including permanent members of the UN Security Council, reached agreement with Iran on ensuring the peaceful nature of that country's nuclear program. As early as next week, Congress will begin voting on whether to support that plan. And the outcome will matter as much as any foreign policy decision in recent history. President Obama and I are convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that the framework that we have put forward will get the job done. And in that assessment, we have excellent company. Last month, 29 of our nation's top nuclear physicists and Nobel Prize winners, scientists, from one end of the country to the other, congratulated the president for what they called, quote, a technically sound, stringent, and innovative deal that will provide the necessary assurance that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. The scientists praised the agreement for its creative approach to verification and for the rigorous safeguards that will prevent Iran from obtaining the fissile material for a bomb.
Secretary Kerry also warned congressional rejection would be destabilizing. Congress is due to debate the agreement next week before taking a vote on it. Critics have argued it does not do enough to guarantee Iran will not develop nuclear weapons and would endanger U.S. ally Israel by allowing Iran to use newly unlocked funding to support terrorists. Majority Republicans in both houses of Congress are opposed to the deal. For more reaction, International Edition's Susan Yaki spoke with Omri Siren of the Washington-based Israel Project, who works with journalists on Middle East issues.
Well, there's a range of reasons why the agreement is bad for America. The two overarching ones is that it forces us to sponsor the Iranian nuclear program for the next 10 to 15 years. And the second is that it disables us from opposing Iran conventionally. As Iran marches across the region, destabilizes our allies, attacks our allies, funds terrorism. You know, that first thing, Susan, is about sponsoring their nuclear program. There's an annex to the JCPOA, the Final Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that Annex 3 specifically, that calls on the parties to engage in nuclear cooperation with Iran. In fact, it's titled Nuclear Cooperation. And it obligates, there's a section that obligates the parties to assist Iran in preventing nuclear sabotage. Secretary Kerry was asked by Congress, hey, does this obligate us if the Israelis decide to cyber attack Iranian nuclear facilities? Does this obligate us to side with Iran against our Israeli allies? And the secretary's response was, don't worry, it'll never come to that. Well, a lot of people are very afraid that it'll come to that. And in any case, most Americans and most of Congress would rather spend the next 10 to 15 years trying to hamper Iran's nuclear program rather than trying to protect it. And then the second reason why it's such a terrible deal is it disables us from opposing Iran's conventional military in addition to sponsoring their nuclear program. There are passages throughout the JCPOA, including the final line of the main text, paragraph 37 of the main text, that in which Iran says that any reimposition of sanctions is legal cause for them to walk away. And they clarified that to the United Nations in a July 20 letter that they sent officially in this context, that they mean any sanctions, which means that if they march across the region, we'll have no option economically to stop them. And anything that we do that they don't like, they can say, stop it, or we're walking away. So they hold a gun to our head for the next 10 to 15 years. And again, this is the same. This is an analogous choice to what we have in the nuclear dimension, which is the majority of Americans and the majority of Congress want to spend the next 10 to 15 years hampering Iran, not being prevented from getting in Iran's way. And so those are the two real overarching costs of the deal, in addition to the fact that our negotiators caved on a range of transparency measures and, in fact, prerequisites to transparency. These go under the banner of the so-called possible military dimensions of Iran's program. We're not forcing the Iranians to come clean. We don't know what they have. We can't guarantee that they've given it up. And even if we could catch them, we'd be disabled from calling their bluff because we'd become too invested in this bad deal by then.
Omri Sirin of the Israel Project speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. Polls show Americans remain significantly divided over the Iran nuclear deal. Social media is saying a good deal about the Iran deal. International Edition's G. Abby Lee brings us up to date on Twitter reaction.
Hello, Ray. Today's segment is going to be a compilation of tweets supporting the deal. This is, of course, in light of the Obama administration securing enough votes in the Senate to preserve the Iran nuclear deal. Let's start with the Iran deal account at the Iran deal, set up by the White House to raise awareness and support for the deal from the American public. It tweeted, "The hashtag Iran deal will reassure the world that even the hardest problems can be addressed successfully by diplomatic means." That's a quote by Secretary of State John Kerry. Kerry himself has been tweeting a lot today. One of the tweets reads like this, "Hashtag Iran deal reflects our determination to protect interests at home and in the region. Key elements of deal last lifetime of Iran's nuclear program." He's on Twitter at John Kerry. Last but not least, Vice President Joe Biden shared a tweet from the New York Times and wrote this, "The hashtag Iran deal is the best available option to block Iran from a bomb. It's in our national security interests." He's on Twitter at VP, simple and to the point. The New York Times tweet, by the way, was about Senator Barbara Mikulski supporting the nuclear deal.
I see. So certainly there must have been some opposition, G. What about some tweets that don't like the deal?
Absolutely. There were some from the Republican side, and here's one that got the most attention on Twitter. And of course, it's by Donald Trump. He wrote, "A terrible deal with Iran. No elaboration whatsoever except a link to a picture on Instagram of President Obama." That tweet was marked as a favorite by nearly 2,000 people. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hungary continues to deny economic migrants and refugees permission to get on board trains at Budapest for transit to Austria, then Germany. Reports say at least 2,000 people were stranded at Budapest's train station on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the flow of boats continued to leave the Libyan coast for Italy or rescue in the Mediterranean and the shores of southern Europe. International Edition's Jeffrey Young continues to focus on this situation. He spoke with Peter Roberts, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London, who says human traffickers are the ones behind the boats full of refugees leaving Libya.
There are boats leaving daily, several a day, that are moving both from Libya and from Syria across into Greece and Italy, carrying thousands of people every day across to the mainland of Europe.
Well, somebody has to operate these boats. Are these human traffickers that are chartering boats? What can you tell me about the mechanism of this transport?
What it appears to be is a series of human trafficking organizations and groups, some of them ad hoc, some of them organized and into organized crime, who have leaped upon this business opportunity to strip migrants of their money before they get into Europe. They're charging up to $20,000 to get across the piece of the Mediterranean into mainland Europe, and they are getting the migrants, often without life jackets or any supplies of food and water, into old fishing boats, old naval boats, or even just inflatable dinghies that you can buy at a supermarket, and then sending them across, sometimes with a captain, sometimes without. The lucky ones will have an outboard engine with sufficient fuel to get them across the mainland. But often, this is not a prerequisite for taking money from people and sending them off. They will arrive on a beach not knowing what type of vessel they're getting into. They'll get pushed into one vessel and sent on their way, and normally that's about as far as the trafficking organizations will take them, and they disown responsibility from then on. Some of the boats do contain captains. Normally, just like piracy, this is where fishing no longer provides enough financial incentive for people, and the captains and crews will then be paid by the human traffickers to try and get these people across to Europe. And they'll sail a straight path across to Europe, hoping that their boat doesn't break down on the way there, and perhaps that they will make it to shore on the Italian side.
From the Libyan coast to Sicily, what is the transit time on average? I realize that, you know, boats have different speeds, but just give me an idea as to how long people would be out in the open water between Libya and Sicily.
Well, you know, it's as difficult to calculate that as it is to calculate how long it would take to get from Cuba to Florida, because it appears that lots of these boats that we're seeing either don't have the fuel to make the trip, or where they do make the trip can only make 5 or 6 knots. They could be at sea for 24 hours. Some of them have been at sea for 10 days when they've been picked up. There really is no mean standard time for getting across, and nor do the human traffickers sell their passage on this of these trips to people based on any particular time to get across. It's just on the hope of delivery.
Peter Roberts, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London, talking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. A humanitarian disaster is unfolding in Yemen. Aid agencies warn the country is on the brink, with up to 500,000 children facing severe malnutrition and hospitals running out of basic medicines. There are fears Yemen's civil war could escalate as a coalition led by Saudi Arabia tries to drive back Houthi rebels who seized control of much of the country earlier this year. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Standing amid bombed-out buildings in the heart of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, the Al Sabeen Hospital is a lifeline for children and pregnant women. But it's on the brink of collapse. The aid agency Save the Children provides support to the hospital. Its spokesperson, Mark Kay, has just returned from Sana'a, and he spoke to VOA via Skype from Jordan.
Before the crisis, it had a catchment population of about 300,000. But since the crisis, that number's risen to almost 3 million, with the entire governorate reliant on it for specialist care.
Managers say the hospital has run out of some medicines, including intravenous fluids, anaesthetics, blood transfusion tests and Valium. In the nearby Al Olfi clinic, doctors are noticing a worrying trend, a sharp rise in the numbers of malnourished children. More than 500,000 people are expected to suffer severe malnutrition in 2015. Pediatrician Najiba Ali Al-Ghassal says the situation is critical. We are facing famine with our children, she says. We can't sit by and wait. We call on the United Nations to look at the children who are innocent and shouldn't be experiencing malnutrition like this, their fear and the anxiety we are facing. Aid agencies blame the acute shortages on the Saudi-led blockade and bombing of the Houthi-controlled port of Hodeidah. Up to 90% of hospital supplies were routed through the port. Again, Mark Kay.
So what we really need to see is the de facto blockade come to an end and unhindered access for these absolutely critical goods. Otherwise, more children and pregnant women will pay the price.
Aid agencies warn that across Yemen, around 15 million people lack access to basic health care, and that will likely prove the deadliest consequence of the conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
President Obama became the first sitting president to visit a community north of the U.S. Arctic Circle Wednesday as he wrapped up a three-day Alaska trip aimed at highlighting the effects of climate change. After meeting tribal leaders and fishermen in Dillingham, home to the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery, he went to a local school and joined children in Native American dress as they performed a traditional dance. Mr. Obama later went to Kotzebue, an Arctic town that is battling coastal erosion caused by rising seas. The Arctic is warming faster than any other place on Earth. And that's raising some troubling questions about the spike in Alaskan whale deaths in recent months. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel has details.
Since May, 30 dead whales have washed ashore on the Gulf of Alaska.
And the average for the whole year generally is 8. So it's definitely significantly elevated. And for us, that was a reason for concern.
NOAA marine scientist Deborah Fauquier says this extreme mortality event has triggered an investigation.
We might be able to, you know, figure out, is it a virus? Is it, a ship strike? Is it a harmful algal bloom?
Most algae are safe. The less common toxic alga can cause brain damage or death. The largest such bloom in a decade appeared in June along the Pacific coast from California to Alaska, thanks to warm water, sunny and calm weather. Fisheries in several states were forced to close. Fauquier says scientists will look for signs of the harmful algae in the whales.
So some of the whales actually filter the phytoplankton and the zooplankton, which are the little insects that eat the grass in the sea, basically. So they get the toxin directly from that method. The other one is they eat the fish that eat those. So it just depends where on the food web they eat. And as you go higher up the food web, more toxin gets concentrated.
The waters around Alaska are warming, a trend which began in 2014 and continues today with temperatures 3 degrees Celsius above normal. Scientists say the warming is due to an El Niño weather event and wind patterns and not linked to climate change. But global emissions are warming the planet, heating the Arctic faster than anywhere else. At the beginning of the melt season, Arctic sea ice was at its lowest level on record, a problem for polar bears, walruses, and other marine mammals who use it as a platform to hunt, live, and breed. Fauquier says the ocean is a dynamic system.
For Arctic species, species that normally like cold water, it's going to change the phytoplankton, so it's going to change that the base of the food web. It's going to change the fish. They may go farther north because they don't like warm water. And so then the predators that are mobile are going to have to either follow those fish, or if they can't follow them, then they can starve.
Fauquier says NOAA hopes to explain why the whales died and why they perished in such great numbers. Knowing the cause, she explains, is the first step to understanding the problem. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, living in a box. Literally, this is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Jason Barnes' bionic right forearm. That's what's new. Jason is a drummer, so having his right forearm amputated after an electrical accident in 2012 should have put a bit of a crimp in his career plans. Instead, many consider him the fastest drummer in the world thanks to a robotic prosthetic. The prosthetic actually holds two sticks. One stick is controlled by Jason's bicep muscles, while the other stick is automated and improvises a rhythm in sync with the first stick. Here's Jason Barnes.
I did not imagine that I would have two sticks on one arm or be able to play at speeds, you know, not humanly possible, but it's a time and place for everything.
Georgia Tech professor Gil Weinberg developed the bionic forearm that lets 23-year-old Jason Barnes be the world-class drummer he's always wanted to be. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Housing comes in all shapes and sizes. The same can be said for the price. In the San Francisco Bay Area of California, housing prices are out of reach for many people. But some young entrepreneurs, artists, and tech industry workers have a unique idea. They're creating their own homes using converted shipping containers. VOA's Michael Sullivan explains.
Artist Heather Stewart is one of 20 people in this small community who live and work in shipping containers or other types of tiny houses. Most are standard containers 6 meters long. She is installing plumbing and wiring in her unit.
We kind of all have enough tools that we can pass them around so that everybody has the resources they need to build what they want.
Stewart and her friend Luke Eisman have been here since April, after city officials ordered them to remove their housing containers from a property they had bought with friends in an industrial section of Oakland. They were told they were violating local zoning codes. They relocated to a massive warehouse at an undisclosed location, where they and their friends have installed a dozen containers costing about $2,000 each. Eisman got the idea after he helped create a metalworking factory in a shipping container that was shipped intact to Kenya. He says it made him realize how useful the structure can be.
A roof that doesn't leak and a floor that's level. So from there, it's more or less aesthetic modification.
The container houses are adapted for the artists and others who live here, like designer Camille McRae.
It's really interesting to be in this space because there are other people doing similar things, and just to have sort of this like richness of ideas and exchanges happening.
People in other cities are experimenting with shipping container houses, and Eisman says there may well be others on San Francisco Bay that are hidden from view.
People have been secretive about it because institutions imposed large fines if you don't comply with their roles.
Eisman and his friends say the lack of affordable housing calls for creative solutions. Michael Sullivan, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Justin Bieber is out with a new song, his first attempt at electric dance music, which he performed on the MTV Video Music Awards. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Border Crossings host Larry London about the tune, Justin's performance, and the video for the new song.
Justin Bieber has a new tune out. It's called What Do You Mean? Larry London, what does he mean? What is he saying with this tune?
Well, it's kind of a love story, and it's an interesting song. It's Justin's very first attempt at electronic dance music, which is now called EDM in the common vernacular. And so it seems that everybody's doing EDM these days. Folks like David Guetta, and the list goes on and on with all the DJs, Afrojack, Zedd, you name it. That seems to be a very in style of music. So Justin Bieber is capitalizing on that with his next album, which is supposed to be an EDM album. The new song came out a week ago, and he sang it for the first time on the MTV Video Music Awards. In fact, it was his first time in 5 years performing on the show.
What do you mean? Oh, when you nod your head yes, but you wanna say no. What do you mean? Hey, yeah. When you don't want me to move, but you tell me to go. What do you mean?
You know, his performance on the VMAs, though, it reminded me a lot, and you can take this as a compliment or not, it reminded me a lot of Michael Jackson.
That's true.
Because it looked almost like Justin was trying to be Michael. There is no other Michael Jackson. But it looked like Justin was kind of trying to do the same kind of choreography, almost like Michael was doing in his preparations for his last tour.
Yeah, Michael's influence is obviously felt throughout that particular number, and certainly the presentation he gave at the award show, where he's propelled on the on these cables over the crowd and whatnot. And then at the end of the song, he said it was unrehearsed. It wasn't expected. He broke down. He just started to break down and cry for a few seconds on stage, which wasn't a part of the plan. It didn't happen in rehearsals.
Right. And, you know, this tune, The video, the regular video, not the VMA, but the video also features an actress, Xenia, what's her name?
Xenia Deli.
Yes.
From Moldova.
And she is very attractive.
Yes.
And Justin, she's got, also in this video is John Leguizamo. Very, very talented actor, but he plays kind of like a hood or a drug dealer in
and
this
And he's
little...
on for a short little cameo at the beginning, and then the rest of the film is, of the video, is them, you know, Xenia and Justin rolling around, getting passionate with one another, then being abducted and in a car and jumping off a building together and doing some interesting stunts. But there was a rumor going around that the two of them were actually more than just co-workers.
Right.
And that has been squelched. Xenia has come out and said, nope, we spend a lot of time together in a short period of time, and we are very good friends. We work together, and that's about it.
It was acting.
It was acting.
It was pretend. Now, Justin, you mentioned he's got a new album coming out. Any title for the album? Or?
It's untitled right now. This will be Justin's fourth album, and it's expected in mid-November.
All right. Well, if you have any comments about Justin Bieber's new track or his new album, you can hit Larry up at @VOA_music. That's on Twitter. You can also listen for his show, Border Crossings. That's on our website, www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Ukrainian government and people continue to struggle to move their country toward peace and prosperity. Despite the challenges that have arisen, in particular from Russian aggression, including Russia's occupation of Crimea in 2014 and the ongoing violence perpetrated by combined Russian separatist forces in eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainian government has worked to implement political and economic reforms and sought to live up to its obligations under the Minsk agreements. Recently, Vice President Joe Biden spoke with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko by telephone. The White House noted in a statement that Mr. Biden congratulated President Poroshenko on reaching agreement with Ukraine's commercial creditors on debt restructuring and welcomed the news of an agreement among several pro-reform political parties to run a common slate of candidates in Ukraine's local elections. Vice President Biden also emphasized the United States' strong support for constitutional amendments proposed by President Poroshenko and Ukraine's Constitutional Commission that will allow for meaningful decentralization of power in keeping with the relevant provisions of the Minsk agreements, while preserving Ukraine's unitary state structure. Unfortunately, on August 31st, after the parliament in Kiev approved a draft of a constitutional amendment giving more power to the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, violence broke out in the capital with nationalist protesters objecting to the amendment. Three National Guardsmen were killed and more than 140 were injured when a grenade exploded in the crowd. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner welcomed the vote by the Ukrainian parliament in support of decentralization, calling it an important step towards good governance for all Ukrainians, which also helps fulfill another key piece of the Minsk agreements. But Mr. Toner deplored the violence that followed the vote. We call on all Ukrainians, no matter their affiliation or organization, to respect law and order. We fully respect Ukrainians' right to engage in peaceful protests, but in a democratic society, grievances must be addressed peacefully and lawfully. Ukraine has been valiantly standing up to Russian aggression while at the same time seeking to implement important reforms that will improve the lives of its citizens. The United States will stand by Ukraine as it continues its path forward on reform and urges all Ukrainians to participate peacefully and lawfully in support of a democratic Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.